Welcome back to Season 12 of The Global Inquirer.
We are an undergraduate research podcast based out of the University of Virginia, bringing you stories from across the world to explain how global trends are impacting real lives and international politics. We're sponsored by the UVA International Relations Organization. I'm your host, AJ Lorienti. Today, we'll be discussing the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, a long-standing, volatile dispute in the post-Soviet South Caucasus. To learn more about this topic, I'm sitting down with Rafi Kanain, a third-year public policy major, Christina Racanelli, a third-year foreign affairs and Spanish major, and Daniel Butt, a third-year sociology major. How are y'all doing today?
Good.
Great.
Thanks for having us. We're excited to be here.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, let's get right into the first question. To get started, can you give me a brief overview of the history behind this conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh?
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast here. My name is Armik Mirzayan. I am a professor in linguistics. I'm housed in the anthropology department here at UVA, but I teach mostly linguistics. And my background, academic background, is in linguistics, language revitalization, language endangerment. And my background originally, I'm Armenian, but I grew up in Iran for most of my childhood. I would say between very early childhood up to about 14 years old, I was in Iran. And my family is Armenian. They're from the northern area of Iran and across the border in Armenia. And so we kind of span that area where my family came from. But I grew up myself in southern Iran because my dad worked in southern Iran. And so we moved to Shiraz. So I came to the United States in 1986. So I just went back to Armenia this past summer.
Oh, wow.
So I was there in July, August. And Armenia, having become a Christian state very early on. So I think the fact that we have had Christianity with us for so long, we've also created a lot of Christian like monasteries and old churches that are all over the region. And so the regions that have been taken over by Turkey by the Ottomans, I should say, building up to World War I. And then more recently by Azerbaijan in the last 20, 30 years, they have actually systematically tried to destroy our historical churches. The graves of our ancestors have been destroyed. I think religious conflict has played a big role there. But it is interesting, if you go to those 18th, 17th, 18th century documents, it appears that local, what they called vilayats, lived actually relatively close to each other, and you didn't get this massive scale problem. Like, some were Muslims, some were Christians. So I think it's the religion coupled with nation building and this idea of empire building that becomes much more problematic. It's not within the religion itself. It's the powers that try to use religion as a means of doing ethnic cleansing or taking over places that are involved massive colonization. It's usually in those contexts that religion gets used as a tool, is what it is. But in itself, neither of these religions.
Sure, I'm Jeffrey Rossman. I'm associate professor of history at the University of Virginia. And I teach Soviet history and genocide, comparative mass violence. Well, the Russian Empire fragmented beginning in 1917, and out of that came a very brutal civil war. First, during the civil war, a number of the states became independent. So there was an independent Georgia, there was an independent Armenia. Poland gained its independence, Baltic states gained its independence for a brief period of time, about 3 years. Ukraine was independent. So the empire fragmented on national lines. And so the Bolsheviks then, during the civil war, they managed to reconstruct about 80% of the Russian Empire as the Soviet Union. So there was an independent Armenian Republic, and with the Armenian genocide having just taken place, and pressure coming from the Bolsheviks, the leaders of the Armenian Republic felt that their safest bet would be to join the Soviet Union, because that would obviously give them protection.
So basically the history behind the conflict in this region originates with the Soviet Union's decision to give the majority Armenian populated Nagorno-Karabakh region to the Azerbaijan Soviet Socialist Republic in 1923. And by creating an Armenian populated enclave in Azerbaijan, the Soviet Union basically set the stage for an ethnic conflict. As the Soviet Union was nearing collapse, Karabakh Armenians in 1987 sent a petition for union with Armenia, and this caused backlash in Azerbaijan and led to pogroms against Armenians in Azeri cities like Sumgait in 1988, Ganja in 1988, and Baku in 1990. And it also ultimately led to the first Nagorno-Karabakh War that lasted from 1988 to 1994. As highlighted by Professor Mirzayan, teaching linguistics at the University of Virginia, the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh is due to the region being stuck between various empires looking to do nation building through propaganda and ethnic cleansing, such as the Russian Empire, the Persian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. This helps contextualize why the Soviet Union gave Nagorno-Karabakh to Azerbaijan, despite being mostly populated by Armenians. The Soviet Union hoped to appease Turkey and bring them under the communist sphere of influence by giving Nagorno-Karabakh to Azerbaijan, as Turkey and Azerbaijan are very close allies.
Thank you, Rafi, for providing that really essential context for the current conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh. To bring it more to the present, though, what have the most recent developments in this conflict been?
Yeah, so this is a very hot topic. Just this past year, the most recent development in Nagorno-Karabakh was the Azerbaijan offensive in September of 2023 that successfully took over the region and led to the exodus of 120,000 Armenians. This offensive was preceded by a 10-month blockade of the Lachin Corridor, which is the sole road connecting Nagorno-Karabakh to Armenia and the rest of the world. So this blockade was implemented by Azerbaijanis claiming to be environmental activists in 2022. They illegally blocked the passage of food, fuel, and medicine from the Red Cross and Russian peacekeepers that contradicted the ceasefire agreement after the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh War. Also, touching upon the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh War, as this is pretty recent, Azerbaijan regained all of the occupied territories surrounding Nagorno-Karabakh. And this is kind of the pretext to the conflict playing out today.
So the UN did go to Nagorno-Karabakh about, I think it was 2nd of October, they sent this envoy in there to like look to see what's happened. Well, the delegates are from Turkey, Albania, and Pakistan. And why are there no delegates from other places in this region? Anyway, then it's all under Azeri terms, right? They gave them 1 hour, they can only look in Stepanakert, you can't look outside of there. And they're like, gee, there's only about 50 to 1,000 Armenians left. We don't see anything horrible. There's nothing bad. And apparently that didn't raise any concern that where did the 100,000 people go? I mean, okay, Aliyev can say we told people of Nagorno-Karabakh, which were all Armenians pretty much mostly, you can stay here. Well, nobody really asks. And I don't see this follow up from journalists. I don't see it in panels discussed a lot. There is a history of genocide that plays very strongly in our psyche, in the Armenian psyche, and a genocide that has not been recognized by Turkey or Azerbaijan or by a lot of countries in the world, actually. And so to tell an Armenian, give your arms up, you can live under our Turkic control, I mean, that genocide memory immediately comes. I mean, I don't know what came to other Armenians' minds, but I was like, red flags all over. This is like genocide part two coming, right? So that's why they got up and left. It's like, I'd rather leave and save my family than stay through another genocide.
Thank you so much for giving us a really good overview of what's happening in the region now. Certainly, this is a conflict that's seen a lot of violence and a lot of suffering. On that note, how has the legacy of the Armenian Genocide impacted this conflict?
During the Armenian Genocide of 1915, the Ottoman Empire killed an estimated 1.5 million Armenians, while also displacing and forcibly removing Armenians to the Syrian desert, where they were starved to death. As explained by Professor Mirzayan when we sat down to talk with him, he highlighted how this genocide is frequently on Armenians' minds and impacts the way that they think about the current situations that they're in. And so we can listen to what he has to say in regards to that.
So you do have to connect back to history of what happened between, I would say, 1880s and 1923 to all those Armenian populations in what was Western Armenia at the time, that, you know, all the 1.5 million Armenians that got killed, all their, you know, the mass exodus that happened from what was the Ottoman Empire then. So I think that's a really important part, that it was not a choice. We couldn't have stayed. And, you know, give up your arms and, yeah, we've killed you before, but please give up your arm. Not please, we're going to force you to give up your arms, and then we're going to rule over you, right? So the last time that happened, we got all killed.
The differences and the struggles that the Armenians underwent, and the fact that there are so many differences that kind of separate them from their neighbors through religion, linguistic differences, cultural differences, and also just political differences, highlights how it really is a difficult situation for them to be in and shapes their minds and their fears, which kind of leads up to a lot of struggles for the Armenian people.
When we saw those destructions that happened in the 80s, in 1998 and 2002, we weren't sure whose graves were being destroyed, because they were going through, the Azeri military went through and systematically. We call khachkar, which are like the khach is cross and kar is stone. So there are stone crosses that mark these graves. There were from about 6th century until when they got destroyed, right? So they systematically destroyed thousands of. And so I'm sure almost that my dad's family had ancestors in those graves that were. They pillaged, destroyed the khachkars, and then they tried to destroy evidence of the khachkars. So you see these bulldozers, and on the Iranian side, actually, across the Arax River, you can see that, those khachkars. So people had filmed it from across the Iranian side. So we have actually like footage of the Azeri army going through, destroying these khachkars and then bringing bulldozers and pushing the khachkars into the river.
Thank you, Christina. On that note of differences between Armenia and its surrounding nations, how does Armenia's status as a democratic nation in an overwhelmingly authoritarian region impact its relationship with its neighbors?
Armenia became a democracy with the 2018 Velvet Revolution. Since Armenia became a democracy, Armenians' relations with the overwhelmingly authoritarian region have deteriorated. When talking with both Professor Mirzayan and Professor Rossman, both of them highlighted how Armenia's status as being a democracy really changes the dynamics and also exacerbates their crisis. As highlighted by Professor Mirzayan, they really do feel and suffer through an isolation in the region and may feel that their situation has gotten even worse with everything also happening in Nagorno-Karabakh and alliances that are being formed in relation to their new broader democracy.
And now, because of this whole nation-state play game, and that we are in this global conflict, basically, this lateral global conflict between what I'm going to point here, what the Russian government is trying to do to keep the West out of that region. And basically, Azerbaijan has become their puppet. You know, so they're not going to care. Russia is not going to care now. If the Russian politicians, Russian people care, but the Russian politicians won't care if Azerbaijan uses more propaganda. In fact, they might even encourage it because it suits their presence in the region. It's a way of Russia keeping itself in the Transcaucasus. And also, you know, with the whole Ukraine war, Russia realized that things may be getting tricky, and also they might lose influence in other regions. And so trying to keep themselves in the Caucasus also allowed them to circumvent those sanctions that were put on them, right? Now they can illegally export their oil through Azerbaijan into Europe, saying, oh, it's Azerbaijan selling it to you, we're not selling it to you, right?
Professor Rossman also highlights how being a democracy does make them fundamentally different than the countries around them, which creates conflicts or presents the idea of conflicts arising.
In that region, we tried to become democratic in 2018 by having a peaceful election, by having a democratically elected president, and now we're paying for it because we're surrounded by dictators, right? If you think about the way Azerbaijan works, well, you know, this has become a dynasty now. It's Aliyev's dynasty, and same thing in Turkey, and the same thing in Russia, actually. So we really don't have that many. We're like this tiny island in an area, so it's also easy to push propaganda when that happens.
So ultimately, through both Professor Mirzayan and Professor Rossman, it truly is a struggle for Armenia to be a democracy when they're surrounded by neighbors that have a lot of different identities within them, and the fact that they're the only democratic one just makes the issue that much more extreme and a precarious situation for Armenia to be in.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I don't follow Armenian politics, but certainly with greater democratization in Armenia and the events of the last several years, as you're pointing out, and this, it's not been a reorientation towards the West, but a more openness to the West, right? Putin inevitably, right, is concerned about those that influence what he understands to be that influence of the West. And so there's at least a lot of suspicion that the Russian government, and that this might have been actually part of the passivity of Russia as well, is wanting to destabilize the Armenian state, because whatever happens in Nagorno-Karabakh is going to have a huge impact on the political situation in Armenia, since it's a huge issue in Armenian politics. And so, you know, Putin doesn't want to have flourishing democratic regimes, right, in any of the territories of the former Soviet Union, right? Because that shows Russians that, hey, there could be an alternative way of organizing society in our country. And so relations have been tense between the government and Russia. So arguably it very well may find out years later when we have, you know, when the archives open that part of the decision not to be involved in the most recent destruction of Nagorno-Karabakh Republic was shaped by this understanding that this might be helpful in terms of destabilizing the Armenian government and leading to a change of government. But that's somewhat speculation, I think, at this point.
Thanks again, Christina, for really outlining how Armenia is unique in the region and also how it struggles with that sort of special status. Keeping the conversation along those lines, how has Armenia's post-Soviet status impacted social contexts, especially regarding the current conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh?
As a post-Soviet country, Armenia and its neighbors have wrestled with the Marxist ideas of post-ethnicity, post-religion, and post-class nationhood. But after you become your own nation state, what other basis do you really have to develop your own national identity? And you have to question yourself, can you even develop a national identity at all? And you can see similar issues in post-colonial countries around the world, where after they gain independence, there's a lot of us versus them narratives that erupt when you suddenly have to contend with having your own nation state when you've never had one before, and you have to prop it up almost overnight sometimes. And in the case of Armenia, we see a people united on the basis of Christianity, Armenian languages. And even then, there's Muslim people, there's multi-ethnic people, there's multilingual people who don't all fit into one box.
So the Soviet Union reconstituted much of the Russian Empire, including the Caucasus regions, but kept the national divisions, which was important because the Soviet Union wanted to emphasize, it wanted to gain support among the people by showing that it was, in its view, an anti-colonial power. It wasn't there to oppress the national minorities. It was there to help them flourish, but flourish under a particular socioeconomic and political system, socialism. And they felt that honoring those national identities would also make the Soviet Union attractive outside of the Soviet Union. So they reconstituted that region on national lines. And for a period of time, the Caucasus states were merged into the Trans-Caucasus Republic, and then it was divided back again into Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Armenia in the 1930s.
And like post-colonial countries, the lines upon which the borders were drawn between Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Nagorno-Karabakh have left Armenians all over the place. Even when most of them are in Armenia, there's still a lot of pressure. Like my colleagues have previously said, that there's people being persecuted in other parts of the post-Soviet world. And those people, especially in Nagorno-Karabakh, have attempted to gain their own autonomy, separate from Azerbaijan, and even separate from Armenia, where they want this land for themselves, where their ancestors have been living for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
So figuring out how to divide that up, and of course the problem with Nagorno-Karabakh was if they kept it separate, or they tried to join it with Armenia, you'd have this hole, right, in Azerbaijan, because Nagorno-Karabakh is not connected to Armenia proper, right? So it made more sense to keep it within Azerbaijan, since it was surrounded by Azerbaijani territory, but at the same time allow for a degree of at least formal autonomy to honor the fact that the population there was mostly Armenian.
So in the region that became Azerbaijan and modern Armenia, that region, I mean, basically what you have is nation states. I think it's the creation of this nation state, again, that's caused a lot of problems in the region. So when you're trying to define yourself as a nation state, you usually latch on to idealistic, nationalistic ideas. And to disseminate that, you have to create propaganda. And so, and some nation states are much better about that. They're very careful to be very inclusive. But other nation states are not like that. They become much more dictatorial and much more like power hungry. And so, and then the same nation state can vary over time. It's not as uniform. But there's one that I can actually discuss that I actually looked into, which is interesting. It's a propaganda of the worst kind, actually. It's tampering with historical documents. If you look at the documents from around 1850, let's say 1810, 1820 until 1870, 1880, there were actually scholars and scribes and secretaries that wrote histories of Karabakh. There's a number of them, actually. And they, in that area at the time, this is like right before Russian influence really took over, actually a lot of the religious documents were in Arabic, because the Arabs had come there between 700 and 900. I mean, so Arabic left an old trace there. They also studied Persian, because that area was Iranian at the time, and you studied Persian, the madrasas, the schools taught Farsi, and that version of it, Persian, from that time period. And so they wrote a lot in Persian. So if you look at those documents, there are several histories of Karabakh. And in those histories, you see references to Armenians in various places that go back in time, including, you know, all the way to the Ark of Noah. It's interesting because in 1989 and 19, so these documents were housed in Baku, at their archives. They have, like, we have the Matan Adaran in Armenia, and they have the equivalent in Baku. And so two scholars, Azeri scholars, get a hold of these documents, and they tamper with them. They were in Iranian, they were in Persian. They systematically took references to Armenia out of these documents, republished. And so, and it's very sad because that, but it also provides propaganda material, right, for state of Azerbaijan. So once you have this dictatorship coming in, they can use this as a nationalistic propaganda. We've been here longer. These people say they've been there, but they haven't, right? So it provides, like, this is 1989, 1990, during that Karabakh war, which was in the early 90s. And so we get this buildup where they can keep pushing this propaganda, make books out of it, teach at schools with it, to sort of falsely tell people that we haven't been there, and so then they can justify their action. So to me, that's a very blatant and terrible use of propaganda, like basically tampering and changing history to make it fit your state needs because you want to conquer and take over.
Thank you, Daniel, for expanding upon the conversation that Christina brought up earlier. To sort of summarize what we've talked about, and also to bring this conversation forward, how do scholars see the future of this conflict playing out?
Scholars anticipate that the conflict is not over yet. Azerbaijan wants to take over Armenian land in the south, known as Sunik, in order to establish the Zangezur corridor.
But, you know, they can actually export their oil that way. So I think they're actually coming for that Zangezur corridor now. They're going to try to take it from mainland Armenia, which is going to, you know, they want us to give that corridor to them because they want more, you know, to create this unified. Again, Azerbaijan and Turkey also want to do empire building and nation state building. So they want to connect themselves to each other, right? And Armenia is kind of smack in the way there.
To the enclave Nakhichevan and connecting Azerbaijan to Turkey, Professor Mirzayan talked about how the UN envoy to Nagorno-Karabakh in October 2023, after the mass exodus of Armenians, concluded that there was no ethnic cleansing in the region. The failure of the international community to sanction Azerbaijan for its genocidal actions emboldens Azerbaijan to further attack Armenia.
Thank you, Daniel, for giving us certainly a pessimistic outlook, but a realistic one nonetheless, of the current conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh.
So I think it's really important for us to change our strategy, strengthen ourselves, and try to make alliances all over the world, not just look locally, because I don't know if, like, you can make an alliance with Iran at the time. At this time, I mean, it's just their worries and concerns are somewhere else right now. We're a very small point, and the rest around us seem to not care so much, so I just wanted to get that message out because it's very important for Armenians everywhere. We say Spyrkahai, which is the diaspora. They need to be aware of this a lot because a lot of us are outside of Armenia.
That's our episode. As always, thank you for listening to The Global Inquirer. And thank you to Rafi, Christina, and Daniel for bringing us this story. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider following us on Instagram @UVA Global Inquirer.